I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to Spark My Muse, everyone. Today, my guest is philosopher, theologian, and author Peter Rollins. Thank you so much, Peter, for joining me today.
Hey, it's great to be on the show. You've had lots of my friends, so I felt like I was the odd one out. So yeah. Now I get to chat with you.
I had to resort to peer pressure to get you on, I think.
No. Exactly. Yes.
I'll do whatever I can. But I've been following your work for a long time, and you've been such an intriguing author and philosopher. I have tons of questions. I probably will have to get you back on again and with another list of questions. But one of the things you've been doing recently is incorporating story into these events called Pints and Parables. And I thought the idea of story is kind of this backdoor or artistic way to get in messages to people. And you know, Jesus used story, and plenty of spiritual teachers through the ages have used story. And I was hoping that maybe you could open up with a story of one of the stories you use at Pints and Parables, or even just tell us kind of what you're up to with Pints and Parables and what your aim is with all of that you're doing now.
Absolutely. I might slip a story in at some point in the podcast, but it's always hard to tell one with no context. I love telling a story that fits with, you know, something that's come up in the conversation. And I mean, truth is, I've been using stories really from when I started my work. Now, the advantage I have is I'm Irish, so people think I'm a storyteller. I'm not really. I kind of had to learn it. But people expect you to tell a story. And when I was teaching philosophy, when I was doing theology, I did the odd time tell a story that I thought would be appropriate or fitted with the theme. And then I realized people really loved that. Mm-hmm. People remembered it. Often people got more out of the story than I intended. The story kind of did something bigger and better than I could have done. And so I started to use stories. And then I remember at one stage I told a bit of a parable stroke joke about this Irish guy called Seamus. And I told a story about Seamus, and people laughed, and it kind of was useful. And then I told another story about Seamus at the end of the talk, and people enjoyed the fact that Seamus had come up twice. So what has happened over the years, for some bizarre reason, is now half the stories I tell involve my friend Seamus in some shape or form. You know, he generally appears at some point. And then, of course, most recently, a friend of mine said, well, what if instead of just using stories and parables as part of what you do, what if sometimes you do a night which is just purely storytelling? And he said, what if you called it Pints and Parables and you did them in a pub? And I'm like, Pints and Parables in a pub with Pete. No, we didn't obviously call it that. That's like a bit cheesy. But I thought, I like the idea. I love a good bar. A lot of my work is actually talking about how we have to have more spaces like Irish pubs. So I thought, okay, that's a perfect thing to do. So this year I've been running around all over the place doing these Pints and Parables nights and been thoroughly enjoying them.
Oh, that's good. And what is it about for people who don't know the difference between a bar and a pub, or why that might be a different kind of space for really enjoying story? Maybe you can enlighten those people.
Yeah. Well, so a lot of my work, for anybody who's new to my work, a lot of what I try to explore is how do we not run from our doubts and our pains and our difficulties, but how do we actually face those things and how do we work through them? We often tend to try to bury everything that's painful. In psychoanalysis, it's obviously called repression. Repression is where you take something that's unpleasant and not nice, that's painful, you push it right down there and you just let it fester as an ulcer. And you go like, there you go. Okay, I've got a bad back, but hey, I don't have to look at that bad relationship I'm in. Or I get the odd migraine, but hey, I don't have to look at the fact that I hate my job, right? So we repress. And we can often fool ourselves into thinking that we're having a ball, we're going out, we're socializing, we're having fun. But then at night, when we try to go to sleep, we get anxious or we wake up having nightmares, and we realize that what we're repressing is still haunting us, still doing damage. And one of the ways that we try to avoid suffering is by going to sports bars. In America, you have all these sports bars, and they've got TVs and alcohol, loud music. And you go there to get drunk, listen to loud music, have very superficial conversations because you can't have a deep conversation, it's too noisy, and watch these big screen TVs. Now, that works for an hour or two. And you feel great sometimes. Sometimes you feel awful and alone, but if it works, you feel great. But then you go home and you have the hangover the next day. And not only do you have like a physical hangover, you have a psychological hangover. The suffering that you repressed returns with a vengeance. Now, you contrast that with a good Irish pub. Now, I don't know, not all Irish pubs are like this, but a good Irish pub has all of the same elements as a sports bar. It's got, people, it's got alcohol, it's got music. But the beer is not there to get you drunk. You go to the Irish pub back home after a hard day's work to have a drink, relax, and talk about your week. Your friends, it's not superficial conversation because you can't hear yourself think. You actually talk about the good stuff and the bad stuff that's happening. You talk it through, you bring it to the surface, you listen to each other, and you're there for each other. And the music isn't designed to be so loud and superficial that you temporarily forget everything. You've actually got some real sad Irish guy in the corner singing about how he only ever loved once and how his beloved died of consumption at the age of 20 and he'll never love again, right? And the thing about that music is you listen to it and at first it sounds depressing and whatever, but then you think about your own life and listening to his or her sufferings, you begin to reflect on your own and you feel better. So the idea of pints and parables is that the point of a parable is in a sense to bring up stuff that you can't look at directly, to bring up struggles and difficulties and help you think. And hopefully it's a technology in the sense of a technology of the self, something that cultivates more grace in your life, cultivates a sensitivity to other people, whatever it is. And so doing parables over a pint in a nice Irish pub just feels like the right environment.
Just being able to gather with people together in whatever mood or circumstance you might be in without having to put on a mask or, you have to come with a happy smile on your face because maybe you'll bring other people down, that you could just come and bear each other's burdens. And hopefully that's actually what church could be, but people don't always necessarily run into that in that environment. But sometimes these other spaces provide those places where we can be our real selves. And that's a really that's a fascinating insight. And I know there are places like that in the United States, but there's something about, like you're saying, the Irish pub situation that is sort of a cultural thing. And because this sort of relates, I wanted to ask you about this term I wrote you about this, that J.R.R. Tolkien talks about, you catastrophe. I don't know if he coined the word or, and he was relating it to Irish culture and the music and the culture that mingles joy and sorrow together. You can hear it sometimes in the folk music and in other things that is okay holding that tension together.
Yes.
I don't know if you know what I'm talking about or if you agree with it or could speak to it in any way. Do you see that in contrast with American culture or other cultures?
Well, I love the term. I hadn't heard of the term when you wrote to me, but it immediately resonated. I mean, I felt it in my body whenever you talked about this experience. Now, I like to call these spaces deserts in the oasis, because in the oasis of our lives, on the noise and busyness of our lives, we need these desert-like spaces where we can, enjoy our lives and also talk about the difficulties. And whenever you told me the word, the first thing it reminded me of is this gathering that I was part of in the UK. It was a festival called Greenbelt. And we did, I can't remember the name of it, but you walked into this room and we'd got this 18-foot woman. Now, they're hard to find, but she was standing on these step ladders, but you couldn't see her legs because we'd created this massive dress from secondhand sweaters that we'd got out of an Oxfam. We'd knitted them together So in this room with like 3,000 people, she stood there in the middle, and on the stage we had a tiny 12-inch marionette that was going to do the main talk. But the thing about the dress that the woman was wearing was it was all unraveling, and all of the threads spread across the auditorium to these people who were knitting new clothes out of the unraveling of this great dress. And I can't go into the ins and outs of everything we did, but the first half of the gathering was about unraveling. To unravel, it was about questioning, about looking at the political, religious, cultural views that we have and rethinking them. And then the second half of the service was about raveling. Now, the interesting thing about raveling is the word raveling and the word unraveling mean exactly the same thing. So what's interesting, and what I love about it is unraveling sounds negative, right? I'm unraveling. If you say your life is going bad, I'm unraveling, everything's unraveling around me. And then the word raveling sounds really positive, right? And what we were playing with is the idea that actually, instead of thinking that there's a time and a place beyond having doubts and uncertainties and anxieties about life, actually, what's important is how do we change our way of experiencing doubts and anxiety and those difficulties in life. So the unraveling is how we experience them often at first, but actually, can we experience them as raveling? Can we revel in them? Can we enjoy the doubts, the complexity, and the ambiguity of life? Can we actually learn to have a space where we can talk about those parts of our lives and be able to bear the full range of the human emotions? And I think that's what I hear in that word that you gave from Tolkien. Could you say it again?
Yeah, it's eucatastrophe. So it's like
Eucatastrophe.
euphoria, but the same two letters. So eucatastrophe, it's the catastrophe, but the you part is the redeeming, if you will, part of the word.
Yes,
Yeah, so it's the good undoing, and it's like a on a previous podcast I did with Shane Tucker, who spent 11 years in Ireland learning to be a soul friend through Jesuits there. He talked about this in terms of soul friendship and spiritual direction, and he really kind of works this into his work with spiritual direction and kind of understanding walking with people, and in a really similar way to what you're saying, that it tends to be that in the United States we think of, I guess it's capitalism, you know, if you, there has to be a problem to solve to sell something, you know. But if you think of that, all things in a sense are good undoings, that you can hold a tension of sorrow and joy and unraveling and unraveling, like you're saying. So the eucatastrophe is a catastrophe that can bring about good.
This is actually connects with a little memento mori that I got made. A memento mori is you're nodding your head, so you know about this. It's an old medieval tradition where you would have a little memento of death, a memento mori that would sit on your desk and would just remind you that you're finite. And of course, most of the time it's a skull. So if you look at these old paintings, you see a skull on the desk of the intellectual. So I created a little memento mori, and it was a happy reaper. Instead of a grim reaper, because death is a name for lack, so lack, nothingness is always bad. I thought, well, what about a happy reaper? And I used this little symbol as a way of talking about exactly what you're speaking of, that lack and nothingness does have a painful side to it. Of course it does. And initially it's very painful, and questioning and unknowing can feel scary. But there is this way of finding a strength and passion and fuel from that very nothingness, from those very things. And a lot of life, psychoanalysis is very is much about this is why psychoanalysis is one of my areas of interest, is psychoanalysis is often looking at how do we make our kind of weaknesses, our symptoms, into something positive, something liberating, something transformative. And so, yeah, the happy reaper is my way of trying to say the same thing as Tolkien is saying.
And it's really out of the negative that we can even see the positive too, because if you are, I'm just wondering, like, that contrast of the memento mori and also some of the Dutch painters that worked with vanitas, that those ideas of vanitas and, you know, all is vanity, but they weren't morbid. They were just realizing, like Ecclesiastes, that now is the time we actually have. And so this is where you show up and live, and this is where you show up now.
Yeah, the irony, by the way, is like a good Irish pub is the most happy and fun place to be, and actually a nightclub is often the most depressing place to be. Like, if you're in a nightclub at like 2 a.m., maybe not at 9 or 10 or 11, but if you're in a nightclub at 2 a.m. in the morning and you look around, it's hard not to imagine that if you turned on the lights and you turned off the music and you just asked everybody to look at each other for 10 seconds, that the room wouldn't be full of people weeping together, right? That you see it in the symptom. It's like the person who's holding their drink nervously or looking at their phone at the bar. There's a sense in which behind all of the joy of a nightclub is actually deep sadness. And yet behind the kind of like the local Irish pub in Galway, where like a pile of old people are sitting around having a drink, and you go, oh, this seems a bit depressing. And you go in and actually, no, by 12 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning, everybody's playing instruments together, laughing and joking together. At the same time, in the nightclub across the road, it's just awful and depressing, and the smell of vomit is everywhere. In the Irish pub, it's like everyone's got their instruments out and they're singing about life and death and suffering and joy. You know, I'll tell you where I'd want to be, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Everybody in the nightclub is a little, there's a little bit of dread, and everybody needs sort of like a hug.
Yes, a little hug.
A little bit of a hug. Yeah, because the dread starts to sneak up on you just about at last call in a nightclub. And then the next day you have to do it all over again.
Yeah.
But in the pub, you know, you're in it together, and you're a little bit merry, perhaps on some alcohol, but you're not obliterated, and you know that you're in it together, and you're going to do it the next day, but you're going to at least know that you have some people have your back.
Exactly. A lot of people don't even drink in the Irish pub. A lot of alcoholics and stuff, they just go in, have a coffee. Like the pub that we did Icon in, the community I was part of, there was a guy there every single night of the week in the menagerie, always with his cup of coffee. And he'd be there from 6 to like closing time. He was part of the very fabric of the community. But he was there because that was the place. And see, people say to me, this is very depressing. You want us to look at the darkness. You want to look at the difficult things. And I have to say to people, I promise I'm not trying to make you depressed. I'm telling you that you already are depressed. You just don't know it. That actually so many of us are depressed and we run from it. There's a beautiful saying, gone but not forgotten. Where, you know, if someone dies, they've passed away, but you remember them, you mourn them, and they remain with you in a healthy way. But for most of us, the truth is forgotten but not gone. But what I mean by that is we try to forget when someone dies or something painful happens. We forget it and we move on, but it remains within us, and it remains within us in a painful, damaging way, destroying our lives. Through physical ailments, through bitterness, resentment, fears, anxieties, all of that stuff. So my whole thing is actually the irony is you bring the stuff to the surface and you find real fulfillment and joy, a real life before death, but you try to repress it. You'll find, you know, you try to keep your life, you'll lose it. But you're prepared to lose your life, you'll find it.
And that relates a lot to what you've said about holy ghosts. And I don't know if you could touch on that a little bit. You're haunted by ghosts and then they can become holy ghosts. I'm probably messing that all up, but I've loved what you've spoken about in that way. If you could enlighten
us. Yes, no, I believe in ghosts. You know, I am a believer in ghosts. I think we're all haunted. What is a ghost? Technically is the presence of an absence. So if you're sitting in a coffee shop waiting for somebody that you love and they haven't shown up, they're absent, they're not there, but you feel their absence, it's present to you. Whereas if I'm in the same coffee shop, they're absent to me as well, but I don't feel it, I don't know. So the absence that you feel is a present absence. The absence that I feel is nothing at all. So the way I use ghosts is I say, well, we're all haunted by people we've hurt and people who have hurt us, things we've said and left unsaid. people that we wish we'd said something different to and we don't have a chance to, right? We all have those people, and they're ghosts because they're absent from us. We forget about them. We don't think about them in our daily lives, and yet they're there, and it comes out sometimes. And what I argue is that if we don't look at our ghosts, if we repress them, they become poltergeists. They destroy things. They really damage us. They hurt us. They make us bitter and frightened. And it can really eat away at our soul. We can die before we're dead. But if we have a community that helps us look at those ghosts, they become holy ghosts. They become something that we can work with them, we can make peace with them, and we can move on with our lives. So that's what I mean by ghosts. Obviously, I'm not talking about the dead returning, but more that all of us have those little elements of our lives that right now, whoever's listening to this, I mean, right now, if they were to turn this off for a second and just sit for 3 minutes in their armchair and just ask themselves, who do I miss? What have I done? Things will come up, every single person. And it's really good to remember that when we're in a room full of people, that everybody in that room has ghosts, have battles that they've been fighting, have things that they're frightened of. And really, we need healthy spaces that can help us make those ghosts holy.
Yeah. And we're really no good for anyone else until that happens, because we're so not ready to be at that point where we can, are so distracted by them and in a way and pulled down by them. Yeah, that's such an excellent point. The friendly fire thing that's coming up, I signed up for that, and I would encourage anybody else to as well. If there's, I'm sure there's still spots, right? There's still spots for that?
Well, they're running
Or,
out fast.
uh-oh.
But it's online, so technically everybody in the world could join and there would still be room. So
Okay.
tickets are running out fast, but we've got a few left.
The miracle of technology.
Still there. Do you want me to say what that is at
That
all,
would
or
be
don't?
really great. Yeah, tell everybody what that is and what you're up to with that.
Well, what's been exciting recently is that, I've been doing this work for 20 years now, but in the last lot of years, some academics have started taking an interest in parotheology, which is the work that I do, in the theory and the technology of that. So a number of academics have been writing papers or doing dissertations or books on the work. There's a journal coming out very soon where five academics have engaged critically with my work. And what the course Friendly Fire is going to do is we're going to look at those critiques. I'm going to engage with them. And so it's a great way actually for people who don't know my work, because sometimes the best way to learn something is to throw yourself into the debates. But actually, it will be of main interest to people who have been following me a little bit and feel like, oh, I really want to go deeper. So I'm loving online courses because I spend my life traveling around the world and I love that. But technology now allows me to sit in my dressing gown in my room, pour myself a gin and tonic, and engage with 500, 600. We had 700 people for my Atheism for Lent course last year.
Wow.
And some people come round to my house and we drink gin and tonics together or coffee together. And then we've got 600, 700 people tune in and engage live or download the lecture afterwards. And it's great because it means that I don't have to like fly out somewhere. It means that I can make the stuff cheap. It's a great win-win situation,
And that's going to take place in September.
September, yeah, end of September.
Okay. Well, this should go out in about 2 weeks, so everybody could still there's still be time
Oh,
for everybody
yeah.
to catch up on that. So that'll be I'm really looking forward to that. And then what else do you have coming up in the next? You'll be traveling, but as far as your work and what's coming out, you always have something new going on, and I see you popping up for Facebook Live things, and so
Oh, I love Facebook Live. I love Facebook Live. Facebook Live allows me to give free content anytime I want. Because in my line of work, that's very key. There cannot be anywhere where I say to you, listen, I'll give you the real secret for $500, right? If you want to know really what the secret to a good life, so really you've got to try and give everything for free. Facebook Live allows me to communicate for free. Now, of course, you have to make your living. So what you do is you 20% is paid, and you go, well, you know, if you want to hang out with me or come to a Pints and Parables, that's going to cost $20. But I really want to be able to give free content, and Facebook Live is great because it's free for me as well. I turn on my iPhone and I chat, and you're in my house, and I feel like I'm in your house. It feels very intimate, and we can discuss things together. I love Facebook Live. But the big thing I'm really excited about is every year I run a festival of 50 people from all over the world, and I bring them to Belfast, Northern Ireland, and for 5 days we hang out together. We see the Irish pub many times. We do it's there's ideas, theology, philosophy, live music, art, poetry, and it's called Wake, because Wake is an Irish this is actually connects with the Tolkien thing as well. Wake is what happens after a funeral or around a funeral, where you remember the dead, but it's also a time of celebrating that person's life and moving on. And so Wake is about the fact that for many of us, a type of God has died, a type of maybe fundamentalism or something in our life has died or passed away. It might be a person. And we want to move on. So Wake provides just 4 or 5 days of space for that ritual of moving on. And we use, as I say, art and music and ideas and thinking, you know, to help do that. So I was just in Belfast last week, getting ready for that. It happens in April. So I'm very excited.
And will this be the third time that you've done Wake?
No, the crazy thing is I'm getting old. It's going to be the fifth time
Oh,
I've done it,
fifth
which is ridiculous.
time.
The first time I did it, I just wanted an excuse to go home because I was missing home, and I was like, I want to go home, but like I can't afford to fly home all the time. What if I did a wee tiny festival, like just with 30 people, and you know that would pay my flights home. I hang out with 30 people, see my family, and then it worked. And I went, okay, I'll do it one more time, and it worked. And so now it's every year, and it's grown
Oh.
for 50, and I'm probably in the next few years we'll probably go up to 75. I don't think I want to go over 100, but it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I guess if it gets too huge, it's not as intimate anymore. But well, how does it work in terms of, do you just rent out an entire space and like move from pub to pub, or can you explain how it works out?
Well, so the first time that it happened, I was before it happened, I was sitting with my friend Adam Turkington, who runs festivals. We're having a drink in this place called the Sunflower, and I told him what I wanted to do. And I said, so what I'm thinking is I'll bring 30 people to Belfast, we'll go to somewhere beautiful, a retreat out in the countryside, and I'll talk for like 3 or 4 days. And he looked at me and he was like, who would ever want to do that? He says, that sounds horrific. He said, like, and I said, Rob Bell does it. I said, yeah, people want to listen to Rob Bell, but you, my goodness. He said, no, you want to do something else. You want to do something else. And he said, if I were you, he said, the whole thing about your work is you love work collaborating with artists and stuff. So if I were you, I'd do a festival, and I would have it not in a retreat center in the middle of a forest. I'd have it in the cultural heart of the city, and I would have it in multiple venues around the city. So that, like, all close knit, so you can walk within 30 seconds, but all these different venues. And I would bring in the artists and thinkers that you respect. And that's what I would do. And so immediately I was like, oh no, I'm going to have to employ you. Can we do this together? So it's like, I'm going like, which of course cuts out what I can make, but I'm going like, but that sounds so good. I need your help. So he's like, yeah. And now we run it together. And he's hilarious because he has no interest in religious stuff at all. Now the truth is, he used to be in a Christian rap band. He'll never tell you this, called Run the JC. So I try to humiliate him by reminding him of this fact every now and again. But he runs it, and he's like, I don't know what Pete's talking about. It's all rubbish to me. But he says, I love these events. I love having 50 people showing them how great Belfast is. And I think Pete's probably doing something that is okay. So I'm in. So
That's
we do
great.
the festival together. So that's what it looks like. Multiple venues in the city. And and a lot of my friends come out and hang out.
That sounds amazing. I hope that and then people from all over the world come, and not just like the United States, but like people are coming from all over the world.
A lot of people from Canada, actually, a lot of Canadians and Australians. So America is probably still the predominant. I would say America, Canada's a close second, then Australia, And then places in Europe. We got like Netherlands. Crazy thing is, nobody knows who I am anywhere in the world except in the Netherlands. They seem to like me out there. I need to move. I need to learn Dutch and move out there. There's virtually nobody from Ireland goes because there's always one or two, but it's mostly from all over the world.
Well, the nice thing about the Netherlands is they speak like seven languages. All of them seem to speak like.
Oh yeah, we actually have two people probably from the Netherlands going to contribute this. Well, one of them's actually German; she lives in the Netherlands, and the other's Dutch. But yeah, we're gonna, and their English is perfect, of course. They can speak multiple languages.
Oh, they're very adaptable. It's one beautiful thing. Oh, well, this is really amazing. And then actually, I did have a question for you that I never prepped you about or anything like that. But in your book, The Divine Magician, this is going back a little bit. I was wondering if you could explain a couple things to me about that, if you can,
I would love
on
to, if I
the
can,
fly.
if
And when you were, for people who don't know what the Divine Magician's about, well, maybe you can summarize that a little bit. But the one thing I was, and then you can answer my question perhaps later, but the one thing I couldn't get over as I was reading it was that as I'm reading about the Divine Magician, which is just, I just love your take. It's so brilliant. I love the there's these three, well, you'll explain it in a second, but the one thing that kept catching me and distracting me was that I'm thinking the whole time kind of this postmodern thing where who's the divine magician really? Is it Pete or is it God? And I keep reading that in thinking, is it, being biased in that way in my own reading that's kind of been sort of looking for the angle, the postmodern thing, kind of playing into how I'm reading it. And so it makes me wonder, when you were writing it, were you considering that in your own writing? Were you thinking maybe this is a projection, as I'm writing about God, and this is just a, obviously you're just writing like a rendition of, in a way it's a parable too, I suppose. But obviously you'll be the better one to answer that than I am, because I'm just spitballing here. But
Yeah, so who is the divine magician? That's is that like is
yeah, sort of like, I mean, when I'm reading what you're writing, I'm thinking this is just genius stuff. And I'm thinking, in a sense, I'm thinking I don't. I'm thinking it's also a construct. What you're saying is also a construct, and that it tells me more about you than it does about God.
Well, that's very true about, all of our conversation about God is it often tells us a lot more about ourselves than anything else. Even in terms of relationships, often when you talk about somebody, that tells you often a lot about yourself. Because if I'm relating to you, I am picking up on the things that connect with me. Maybe the things that I like or the things that, that reflect something of my values, and I probably ignore other things that are as equally a part of you that I just don't see. So if you listen to me talking about Lisa, you might find out, I say, more about me than you would about Lisa. So anyway, that was just an aside, but you're right. God talk is often, as Karl Barth said, is often talk about ourselves with a megaphone, which means, like bigger, God becomes a bigger version of ourselves. But yeah, so I wonder, I should also probably give a little bit of a background of what I'm doing in the book. But I will tell you this first, you would have liked the subtitle that I wanted for the book. And every time I sign the book, I change the subtitle for everybody. And also I change the typo on page 69 as well. But the subtitle I wanted was The Vanishing Act of God. And I like The Vanishing Act of God because when you read it, it's ambiguous. Do I mean that God is vanishing? Or God is doing the vanishing. And so you're hearing an ambiguity in the title that I want. So you're the first person actually to talk about this. The reason for the title is there's a certain ambiguity. Who is the magician? What, who's doing this vanishing act? In some respects, I'm saying that the religious facilitator, the facilitator of the religious space, the liturgy. Liturgy is the technology of theology. Just as the technology of psychoanalysis is the clinic, or the technology of of chemistry is medicine. The technology of theology is liturgy, as in you go to a space, and in that space, hopefully, you're transformed. You're cultivating a grace in your life or whatever, ideally. And so the divine magician, the idea is that a certain form of God disappears in that space. And you'll already know this, but just for your listeners who don't know my work, the basic argument of the book in a nutshell is that we often fantasize that there is something that will make us whole and complete, that will satisfy us, that will make us purposeful, that will take away guilt and unknowing. That might be drugs, might be fame, it might be money, it might be religion. There's any number of people promising wholeness and completeness. And I call this the sacred object. I say theology calls this the sacred object or the idol. And the Bible starts with this idea, the apple is the first sacred object. And we pursue this thing because we think it will make us whole and complete, but we just get more depressed. We never get it. We never get what will make us happy. Because if we do get it, we realize, oh, it didn't actually make us that happy. So that's the sacred object. And I use the idea of a magician because a magician makes an object disappear. And that is the object that Christianity makes disappear. So the magician has the pledge, which is the object, the turn, the disappearance of the object, and the prestige, which is the return of the object. You make a coin disappear and reappear. So the pledge of Christianity is the sacred object that doesn't actually really exist, but we think it exists. Then I say that, the crucifixion is the point when we realize that this sacred object doesn't exist. The temple curtain rips in half. We see the Holy of Holies and there's just a room. And then the prestige of Christianity is the return of the sacred. But it's a little bit different. The sacred is no longer an object, but the depth dimension in all objects. The sacred is the experience of depth we find in embracing the world. So God is not an object that we love. God is that which we find in the act of love itself. That is the whole book in a nutshell. If you understand that, you don't have to buy it. You can still buy it, you just don't have to read it. You have to have the blessings in the buying, but you don't have to read it.
No, buy it. But yeah, there's the that's the point of it is that we will kind of confuse the sacred object for
God.
yeah, and so that's kind of the nugget that is so powerful that and the communion, you talk about that as well, and that's why you should buy the book, people,
Nice.
is that
Yes, because
that's
the
included in there.
Eucharist. The Eucharist is the three parts of the magic trick. You've got the pledge, which is the bread and the wine, the sacred object. You've got the turn, the disappearance in your body. And then you've got the prestige, where you get out of your pew and you realize we are the body of God for one another. So, yeah, it's all there.
That really enriches the experience. If you've been only thinking of it one way, or oh, do this in remembrance of me, but if you actually think of it as having another dimension, or you can bring that into your experience and realize that this isn't just, I don't know, I have this aversion lately to magical thinking, and in a way, magical thinking can, in terms of like the arts or something like that, where we embrace wonder, that's one thing, but magical thinking in terms of where we escape reality, and Christianity becomes meaningless, or Christianity becomes about the future or heaven or something like that, and it doesn't actually help us be better people. It becomes very strange and pointless to have, like, liturgy becomes useless in a sense. And so that idea of the Eucharist being something we embody, and then it turns our community into something vital, I just love that. So anyway, the book link will be in the show notes, as well as like all your website and all the other things that you can get a hold of will be in the show notes to this episode. But I don't know if we should wind up here, or if there was anything else that you have upcoming that you'd like to share with the listeners.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I get around, so hopefully I'm going to be in the area where some of the listeners are at some point. And I'm always up for people hanging out. At any event that I do, I'll the only thing that's definite is that afterwards we'll all go out and grab a coffee or get a drink or hang out. So whether you live Detroit is the next, well, I'm going to Australia and New Zealand next, actually. So next week I'm out there, and then I'll be in Detroit, and then I'm doing some stuff in LA.
And you will try to suffer along with jet lag in some way. You'll try to get through the jet lag. Have you figured anything out yet?
Well, yeah, my basic philosophy is I sleep when I'm tired. So my body now, I don't sleep necessarily at night or during the day. Like this morning, I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I got up and I went for a run, did a bit of work, did a bit of reading. So this afternoon, I'll probably have a nap for a couple of hours. I think my body has just decided I don't know what time it is. So just when I'm tired, I'll sleep. That kind of works for me because I'm lazy. I've never really had a 9-to-5 job. So I think jet lag's only bad if you've got a 9-to-5 job, because you have to be somewhere at 9 o'clock. Whereas I can, I hate to boast, people are going to hate me for this, because like, for all of the difficulties in my life or whatever, the thing that I've got right is I can have a nap in the afternoon. And I know it's a terrible thing to say because people will hate me for it, but I love it. You know, I love my afternoon nap, and I'm very lucky to be able to, most of the time, have it.
That's awesome. Well, naps, I'm a big fan too. If 2 o'clock comes around, if it's possible, I will try to take a nap also.
Yeah, I think it's the main reason why you should try not to have a regular job, to be honest. There's lots of reasons, but I definitely think the lack of nap, the Spanish have it right, because they have a siesta.
That's right.
I could maybe have a regular job in Spain.
Well, they stay up really late too, so.
Oh my goodness, they do. Oh my goodness. Yeah. I can't do that anymore. I like to pretend that I'm a late bird, but I'm not. But they do the Spanish. I was out in Spain. I was in Madrid there recently. Oh, mm-hmm. Everything. I mean, they just start going out for dinner at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If they didn't take a nap, nothing would happen. I don't know what. So yeah, it's different. Yeah. I think, between 8 and 10 people eat supper. So if you didn't get a nap in there, I don't know what will happen, but
yeah, they do have a lovely way of life, because I don't know. Maybe we should start a podcast about travel, different cultures and that kind of thing. But the Spanish do have a lovely work ethic. I was in Madrid, and they don't work that hard, but they're hardworking. But they appreciate friendship. They appreciate relaxing. Mm-hmm. It's a lovely pace of life.
Yeah, I noticed that also in Italy too. What they will just shut down in the middle of the afternoon, even if there's tourists visiting, the gates just all close to the stores, and they just have 2-hour, 3-hour lunch with the families. And that's just how it is. People just have to go elsewhere for their stuff. Yeah. And it's family time in the afternoon too. So
yeah,
it's a beautiful thing, because it's the relationships, not the commerce, that's the most important thing.
No, the U.S. is quite a hard place to live in many ways. Financially, it really is. Like, you have to work very hard, and it is a lot about, and I understand, you have to make the money because you have to pay for like medical stuff. And, so you have to, my goodness, it's expensive to live in America. So, but you do get the feeling that you know, it's all about having to kind of make enough money to live. And so when I bring American friends to Ireland, they're amazed that like things close at weird times. And, you know, like in Sunday night, Sundays facing nothing's open. It used to be in Belfast, nothing was open on a Sunday, and a lot of everything, bars close at midnight, and all of these weird things. But it's because like people, they don't need as much to live, you know, so they can take more time off.
Well, you know, it's funny because you've picked to live in LA, which is kind of in the United States, LA is kind of like the most plastic, weird place in the United States to live. But where I live, the cost of living is really low. And so it pays to not move where I live. So it's the cost of living is really low. You don't need to have I don't need to have a full-time job because my husband works full time, and so I can have a part-time work. But if we moved, then I would have to work full time. And so if you pick a good place to live in the United States, you can pick a lifestyle that is much less treadmill
is
crazy.
True. And so I love the idea of Detroit, by the way, because that's a cheap place to live, and I really love the city. But yeah, no, I know.
Yeah, so it depends on where you pick, and some places are very rural, and so it totally depends on if you think. If you have little wants, but if you don't need things, excuse me, if you don't need things, you can pick many places in the United States. It's just a matter of what your priorities are. But because I don't need, I never need a new car, or I don't need a lot of clothing, or I'm low maintenance. Yeah. It doesn't, you know, you can get by even with a family of, like we have a family of four, you can get by on $40,000 a year, depending on where you live. It's actually, unless you're trying to keep up with the Joneses, it's possible. It's just not typical yeah. in the American way of life. And so yeah. that's the countercultural thing. But I still think that, you know, it's countercultural to think that way, but I still think it's possible. It's just a matter yeah. of, I guess, deciding what's important to you. And
yeah.
And so
I've lived in expensive, you know, I was on the East Coast for a while, on the West Coast, but I'm in LA because it's the religious mecca of America. It is, yeah. you know, if you define religion as the place that promises certainty and satisfaction, then religion is in the secular world, the religion is in LA. There's a shaman on every corner promising wholeness and satisfaction if you only take ayahuasca or yes. have enough money or enough fame. The tyranny of happiness is so palpable here. You walk around, and because my work is about freedom from the tyranny of happiness, not freedom to pursue what will make you happy, but freedom from the pursuit of what will make you happy. That is a message that is a very important in LA.
Yes.
You know, the only place I know that needs it more is probably Vegas, which yeah. is just up the road. So
exactly. Yeah. Well, that's actually what I was going to ask you is, I think I've heard you say that before, and you see that LA and Vegas is a close second. That's maybe more touristy perhaps, but there's kind of this siren call in LA to, you know, do the plastic surgery or find your fortune in LA, or, you know, go to Hollywood and get a you know, fantastic film career or something like that.
Yeah.
And it seems like there's a lot of, there's a lot of promises in LA, and a lot of, I mean, you felt drawn to go there because that was the place that had the deepest cry, or
in some ways, yeah, because, you know, the Bible, if you in Genesis, you've got this really interesting minor bit of the creation story. The serpent says to Adam and Eve, if you eat this piece of fruit, you will be like gods. Mm. Now, what that technically means is to be like a god is to lack the lack. So the idea traditionally, God lacks the lack that we feel. You know, God is full, complete, whole. There is no doubt, unknowing, whatever. So when the serpent says, you eat this piece of fruit, you will be like gods. It's, you will eat this piece of fruit and you'll be whole, happy, complete. Now, in psychoanalysis, that's called the superego. So in theology, it's called the serpent. Psychoanalysis is called the superego. But it is that internal voice that is us, but that feels like it's not internal, that tells you you should be happier, you should be doing more, you should be, you know, having more sex or having kind of, you know, more socializing or whatever it is. It's this voice that tells you, if only you had that car, if only you had that house, if only you had that relationship, then everything would be wonderful. And my work is largely about, how do we crush the head of the serpent? How do we destroy the superego injunction that is demanding, you know, perfection? Because the demand for perfection makes us feel unhappy and imperfect, right? The very thing that we think is, you know, good is actually causing the problem. And LA has that serpent, the serpentine superego voice telling you, you should look beautiful. You should be thinner. You should wear this. It's everywhere. Like, you walk down LA and it screams from every pore of the city. It's quite incredible. I quite enjoy it because I'm amazed at how strong it is. But it's dangerous, very, very dangerous for people.
That's not why you're jogging, right?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't even say it's jogging. I say I jog, but if anybody ever filmed it, it would be hilarious, because I basically half jog half a block and then get out of breath and walk home. It's a pitiful excuse for a jog, but yeah, I'm getting older, so I thought I need to do something.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if LA was rubbing off on you or what was happening there. But if you were jogging, I was thinking, could this be an influence of Los Angeles? I don't know, but
well, I did jog, but I didn't mention that I also had a big bar of Galaxy chocolate that I brought back from Belfast. I'm still the unfit Irish guy.
Oh, that's good. Well, I probably should wrap it up and not take too much more of your time, but this has been such a joy, and I'm very, very grateful to you, Peter.
Well, listen, thanks very much for having me on the show. Really appreciate it. And hopefully we can do this again sometime.
Yes, I would love it. Yes. And good luck in your travels. I will be, of course, joining you for your friendly fire, and hopefully I have you on back again soon.
Fantastic.
Show notes for this episode can be found at sparkmymuse.com. There you'll find details for websites and people and books mentioned in this episode, and sometimes you'll find photos and videos too. Please stop by and check it out.